Before we begin the actual text in Acts 25 today, as we pick up our exposition of the book of Acts, someone asked me about what I have here on the screen, and it's just a reminder that Tisha B'Av, Tisha means ninth, Av is a month, A-V is like March or April or May. Av is a Hebrew month. It would be like from the middle of July to the middle of August on our calendar. Remember, they're lunar, and so it's a different month circumstance. But this is called the Day of Disaster in Judaism, and it's the day of prayer, a special day of prayer. And so just a reminder, because that's coming up on Wednesday evening at sundown, this Wednesday we'll be celebrating or remembering this Tisha B'Av. Because on that day, now remember, on the English calendar, the Gregorian calendar that we use, it'll be a different date. You know, it could be July 23rd or August 10th or whatever, but it's the 9th of Av on that calendar. In 1444, when the Jewish spies returned and told that we can't conquer the Promised Land, and God said, all right, you're all going to die, that the Jews began to remember that day as a horrible day, because obviously that entire generation of 2 million Jews died in the next 38 and a half years as they wandered in the wilderness. They'd already been in the Exodus and at Mount Sinai and so forth, so they had 38 and a half more years, and they all but Joshua and Caleb died. 586, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, tore it down block from block, gold leaf covered, so they set giant fires, melted the gold off of every block of the temple. 70, in the common era, the CE, or we would say AD 70, the Romans did the same thing in Jerusalem and destroyed the temple under the legions of Titus. In 125, the final Jewish revolt took place, and the city of Jerusalem was plowed under. If you go today and look for streets from the time of Christ, you're actually 6 feet below grade level in what are basements now of homes that will have the streets, because they destroyed all the buildings and plowed it all under. And that in 1094, the First Crusade was proclaimed, and the Pope proclaimed that they needed to wet the blood of their sword with a Jewish blood. And so all the knights, the crusaders in France and Germany, went to their neighbor Jews and killed them that day. And then in 1941, Hitler's chief vice president, as it were, came up with a final solution to turn the camps for the Jews and for the gypsies and the mentally ill that they had built all over the Third Reich. They had all these concentration camps, to turn them into death camps. The numbers we have on the side, 2,150,000, 200,000, 500,000, 10,000 in Europe, 6 million. These are the statistics of Tisha B'Av, because all of these events took place on the same day, on the 9th of Av, in those years. You can see why Jews started mourning that day back in the days of Moses, remembered it to the time of Christ, and now remember it even more with all the death and destruction. Anyway, that's a little history lesson, but just to remember this week, it's a very special time. We ask a question as we begin Acts 25. Who's in charge? As a young minister, my first full-time pastorate out of seminary, December 1970, that's 50 years ago. That tells you how old my wife must be. I became an associate pastor of a large suburban church running the Cradle Through College programs. We had about 60 to 100 junior high and senior high that would meet every Saturday for activities and programs and preaching. We had children's activities like Awana Club. Some of you are familiar with these things. Anyway, I was like the proverbial chicken with the head cut off in this large suburban church trying to do all of these things. After 5 months, right out of school, the senior pastor felt called to be a missionary to Alaska, packed up a truck, and left. He drove up the Alcan. The board said, you're going to need help. We've got to get a pastor. It might be years. You've got all this work to do, and now you have teaching adult Sunday school and preaching in the services and prayer meeting. And I said, I can handle it. And the board said, well, we'll see. Lots of good happened, lots of failures also, and I'll let you search for those when the police records are unsealed. At Halloween, for instance, our overnight, we had a haunted teen overnight in a barn out on the edge of town that we were going to have a film and food and games, capture the flag, you know, just the fun things that teenagers do. We planned for 50 high schoolers and had 8 leaders and 1 bus. We had 125 teenagers show up. And 3 days later, I ended up in the hospital with a bleeding ulcer and 2 weeks after surgery there. Being in charge is stressful. With authority comes responsibility. And then with responsibility comes accountability, in my case, to the deacons and the congregation. Thankfully, when I was in the hospital then, they asked an older retired pastor, he was really ancient, probably about the age I am now, but to come in and preach and relieve me of having to do the Sunday service, the main preaching there. They asked one of our young people who were in college to come home for a year and be my youth pastor. And then a few months later called a new pastor with whom I had 100% disagreement, but that's another sermon illustration down the line that happens. Today, we're talking about the new leader, first day on the job, over the sweet political position. You couldn't hardly ask for something greater. Of the 13 major Roman provinces, he was given the province of Syria, which would include, well, if you look at a map of the Mediterranean Sea, everything to the right. It would include parts of Turkey, all of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, half of Egypt, all the way to the Indus River in Pakistan. That was his region. And he became the governor, and Acts 24 ended with the transition by saying that Felix, who was the governor, kept Paul a prisoner for 2 years, talking with him, hoping that money would be given to bribe his release. Nothing happened, except Felix left, and with Antonius Felix gone, Porcius Festus stepped into his role. Now, Felix was a bad man, a worse leader. Festus was just the opposite. He was a good man, given a hard position. The first day on the job, he stepped on a landmine called Paul. What are we going to do with this Paul? You know, how do you deal with the problem like Maria, this songwriter Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote in The Sound of Music? Well, what do you do with Paul? And so, although he governed well, he was in over his head, and it's like he fully intended to say, I'm in charge, you can trust me, I'll do what's right. And everybody around was saying, yeah, we'll see how you're doing. So, let's look at the new politician. You have Acts 25, verse 1. 3 days, just 3 days after Festus arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. This good, energetic leader wanted to head up from the seacoast, the capital of the entire province, to go up to the largest city in the province, to Jerusalem, and try to do what's right. Just, by the way, this is 60 AD now. Okay, Paul's been 2 years in house arrest. It's now 60 AD. And when I looked up the story of Festus, I found out that he was the governor for 2 years, from 60 to 62, where he died while he was serving in office, even though he was just a young man. Well, the chief priests, the first thing that happened, the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul. Yeah, welcome to being governor. They urged him, asking a favor against Paul, that he summon him to Jerusalem. Can you imagine this two-year-old case that they had failed to be able to win a verdict? They failed in their prosecution, even though they brought in a big-name lawyer. 2 years had been sitting in the craw of the Jews. The high priest had died. The new high priest, Ishmael ben Phabas, became the high priest. And he was trying to help the Pharisees, who were all opposed to this renegade Pharisee, Paul, and trying to get rid of him. And so the continuous action of the verb says they continually urged without let up. So here Festus comes up to Jerusalem. Here I am, the new governor. First day on the job. Well, third day on the job. And nonstop. You got to let Paul come up here. We got to be able to try him. They kept him under lock and key in Caesarea. So, and of course, we know why, because the next verse 3, concludes, they were planning to ambush and kill Paul on the way. Their animosity had not let up. There were still 40 men who had sworn never to eat until Paul was dead, and that was 2 years ago. These guys were hungry. Well, we know how they got out of their vow, but, you know, they knew that Paul would be acquitted in a fair trial. There were no witnesses. There were no charges that could even be brought against him. Nothing. He should have been released immediately, and so they're saying, okay, just bring him up here and maybe an accident will happen on the way up to Jerusalem. Wink, wink. Well, Festus, like I said, was an honorable man. This new politician said in verse 4, he replied that Paul was being kept in Caesarea for his own protection, by the way. He was kept there. And Festus said, I plan to return there shortly, so let the men of authority among you go down with me. And since there is wrongdoing with this man, we assume if he's been in prison for a couple years, he has to be guilty of something. Let them bring the charges against him. I'll hear you. And so I appreciate this. The new politician not acting like a politician. A good politician would say, oh, well, okay, that sounds like a good plan. And if something happens, well, then Paul is gotten rid of, I've lost my problem. This is a win-win for both of us. Sure, I'll send for him to come on up with a couple soldiers. No, he knew what was happening. And God was protecting Paul. And he said, just come on down because it's my jurisdiction. And since Paul's guilty already, that's literally a first-class conditional sentence, not if there is something wrong, it's since there's something wrongdoing on this man's case, then, you know, come down, declare it, and we'll judge him. It'll be done. So the new politician gets a thumbs up from me for being a good politician. By the way, those are words that I seldom use in the same sentence today. Good politician. The conflict, however, was the same old conflict that we've seen before. Each chapter in the book of Acts from 20 to 28 builds on the same conflict over and over and over again after Paul has finished his third journey. this conflict with the Jews who want Paul dead. They don't want the message of the resurrected Messiah to be proclaimed. So the old conflict begins in verse 6. You have it there, Roman numeral 2. There were protests here. In verse 6, he stayed among the Jews in Jerusalem no more than 8 or 10 days. Then he went back to Caesarea, and the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. So he gave them time to wine and dine the new governor, present their case on how evil this Paul was and that he deserved to die, and that, you know, if you want to be a good governor, that we're all going to vote for your re-election, governor. You got to think of what's going to happen in November. Well, they didn't quite work that way, but the idea there that for about a week or so, he was wined and dined, and he said, okay, come down there. Because Paul realized that he was never going to get a fair trial in front of the religious leaders. They were going to kill him. Let's face it, he'd been there, done that with Stephen. You remember that? That Stephen proclaimed that the Messiah had come and that this was the answer to prayer. And the Pharisees and Sadducees together, including Paul, stopped their ears and screamed so they wouldn't hear him, picking up stones, dragging him out of the city wall and killed him. Paul knew what was going to happen if he went back to Jerusalem. So he's kind of happy now. Okay, I can't get a fair trial in the religious court, but with the government, I can get a fair trial now. Festus looks like a decent enough guy. Felix, he just wanted money. He's gone. New governor. We would say, yeah, old politician's gone. New politician comes in. Same problem. Same issues. Nothing's really changed. Political party A, political party B, same thing. Well, when they had arrived in verse 7, Acts 25, verse 7, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around Paul, bringing many serious charges against him, none of which could be proved. Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, against the temple, or against Caesar have I committed any offense. Kind of a three-point sermon that Paul is giving here. The accusations, he's a terrible person. And I'm sure that Festus is looking at that saying, that famous line, where's the beef? If he's so evil, if he's so guilty, where's the evidence? Where's the witnesses? Where's the details? Where's the beef? Moses had done, Joseph, Daniel, you could go through the Old Testament and see these same things. Even Stephen, as I mentioned before, had these charges brought against him, and Stephen said, no, against the law of Moses, against the temple, and against Caesar, I've not done anything wrong. They killed him anyway. When we are condemned or accused of proclaiming the Messiah, if we are said, well, boy, you must not be a loyal American if you do such and such, or you might not be a good Christian if... No, who's going to condemn us? Paul wrote in Romans 8:33, who can bring charges against God's elect? Only God, who has justified us. He's already declared us righteous. Then who can condemn? Christ Jesus, the one who died, was raised, and at the right hand of God and interceding for us, he's the only one. And he's already redeemed us with his blood. It's a wonderful little text there in Romans that sometimes we skip over. But Paul was confident that this was a non-issue, that he should be released, that the charges dropped, and he should begin missionary journey 4, which is what he planned. He'd already written about it in great detail. He's going to go to Rome on the way to Spain. That's his plan. Well, how's that working out for you, Paul? He wasn't going anywhere. He was under arrest. But he's hoping now Festus will be a good politician. He'll be a good governor. And so we pick up looking at Festus again in verse 9. It says, but, boy, there's a conjunction. But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, it's from the Greek word to scratch your back. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You know, that type of thing. I want to do that. I want to gratify their itch here. Said to Paul, Paul, don't you want to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried before the council, but before me? I'll be up there with you. I'll be the judge. See, Festus understood that you got a problem with Paul here, but you got this huge problem with all these leading Jews are upset. And remember now, he's only been 11 days in Palestine total. And he's saying, come on, Paul, wouldn't you like to do that? You know, that will work out for all of us best. Now, Paul had standing as a Roman citizen, and he could say, no, I don't want that. You can't make me go there to meet with a civil, a religious council. This is a matter for Roman law. I'm a citizen. And what Festus was doing was asking for Paul's head on a platter. He was saying, come on, it's the best thing. It'll work out okay. I'll be there. You go. We'll all go up to Jerusalem. We'll scratch their back. They'll scratch ours. We can take care. And Paul realized, not only is there no justice in the religious world, there's no justice in the Roman world either. The politics were going to fail him. When Christians depend on politicians, what happens? We are disappointed on every level. Someone said, oh, they have a Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, he's a conservative, he's a good man, who voted to continue the welfare system of Obamacare and voted against the Christian church. And they say, oh, but now we've got, Trump has appointed another conservative, and now there's another good guy in there. And all of a sudden there's a vote on whether churches should be allowed to meet or not in this era of the COVID fear. And the vote was 5-4. And I thought, yeah, that's great. We've got 5 conservatives, 4 liberals. No, the new conservative voted with the liberals. And now the churches in California are, I was noticing John MacArthur and some of the other fundamental Baptist churches like us, with maybe a few thousand more members than we have, but they're meeting. They're saying there's a point where you can't keep persecuting the church. See, because people believe if we just elect the president, we'll get the right Supreme Court. If we just elect the senators, they'll pass this law. Babies won't be killed anymore. How's that working? You see what happens, folks? We're putting our faith and our confidence in the politicians, and they have no more answer than the looters and rioters on the street have. Paul's saying, no, we can't do this. Death awaits him. You know, Festus is on the horns of a dilemma. The horns that had already gored Felix and driven him from being governor. And now he's faced with it, you know, 11 days in. If I side with Paul, all the Jews will hate me. I'll be under trouble for years to come. If I side with the Jews, then Paul and the Christians, oh, what's going to happen here? Paul said, no. We're going to look beyond the circumstances. We're going to look beyond the religious court and the physical court, and we're going to try and appeal as high as it goes. So verse 10 picks up the story. Paul said, I'm now standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews, I've done no wrong, as you yourself know. If I'm a wrongdoer, and have committed anything that I deserve to die. I'm not trying to escape death. But there's nothing to their charges against me. You can't surrender me to them. I wonder if Festus just wanted this to be over and thought, well, maybe this will be the easiest way to be a win-win for me. Paul wasn't trying to escape punishment. If we do something wrong, we deserve punishment. If I break a law, I deserve to be punished. But Paul wasn't a fool. He didn't want to be martyred if he didn't have to be. He wanted to preach. He said, remember, I want to go to Rome. I've still got to go to the end of the world, out to Spain, and preach. He wrote that in 50, whenever it was, 55, 57, when he wrote Romans. Somebody help me there. And he'd written to them saying, I'm coming to see you on my way to Spain. Don't worry about it. And now, where is he? Still under lock and key, 60 AD. Can't get out for the last 3 years to go there, to Rome or to Spain. So he says, I don't want to die foolishly. He said, I'm still young enough, I still can be serving God. And so verse 11 concludes with this phrase, I appeal to Caesar. And after conferring with his legal counselors, Festus answered, to Caesar you've appealed, to Caesar you'll go. See, having his court, his case heard before the highest court, Caesar himself and his advisors, was the right of any Jew after they had been tried in lower courts, if they appealed, if they were a citizen, they could go and bring it before the Supreme Court, as it were. Bring it before Caesar himself. The rights of the Roman citizens had been elevated under one of the previous Caesars, Octavian, Caesar Augustus of the Bethlehem story, you know, the census. He had said that if you're a Roman citizen, you couldn't be unlawfully bound, beaten, or tortured. You had rights. So they weren't called the Miranda rights, and they were called the Octavian rights that you were given because you were a citizen. And so he appealed. Is that a bad thing to do? To let the law work on our side? I stood out on CY Avenue a couple of years ago on a nasty, snowy, cold January to hold up a sign that said, all lives matter. Out in front of on the hillside in front of Planned Parenthood on the day of the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade fiasco, when the 9 black robe justices voted 5-4 to allow killing babies. I just stood out there. Somebody said, well, that's a terrible thing for a pastor to do, to be a protester. Oh, yeah? That's our right. John Calvin, y'all remember Calvin? He was another classmate of mine. Calvin said, God, who appointed courts of law, also gives his people the freedom to use those courts. Make an appeal. Hold up a sign. Now, not a protest like Canada has, where they hold up a sign that says, I'm a little upset. You know, that's their big protest movement. And not a protest like, let's go down and burn down buildings and loot and rape and pillage everything in Portland. But the idea here that I'm going to go to Caesar. Caesar's the king. He says, there's no higher authority on earth, so I'm going to appeal to him. By the way, who was the Caesar at this time? We can play the Jeopardy music if you'd like here. Who was the actual Caesar? What was his name? Caesar Nero? Oh, no. He'd been in all the papers. We know how bad. No, at this time, in his first 5 years, Nero was a just ruler. Nero was wise in his dealing, trying to build up his empire. Not a problem. What does this mean for Paul? Festus, the Jews, it means everything stops dead. The appeal's made. Paul doesn't get out of house arrest. He doesn't say another word in a trial. He doesn't go to Jerusalem to be accidentally killed on the way. There's nothing. It's called, okay, you appealed. The legal proceeding stops. The Roman law had a 2-year moratorium. If you were accused of a crime, they had to try you within 2 years. Felix had already gone over the 2 years. Paul's still arrested. Now Festus picks up. They don't care about the 2 years, but boy, let me tell you, when Paul says, I appeal to Caesar, a new 2-year clock begins that day. And he's got to get to Rome and have a hearing within 2 years, or he's automatically declared innocent and free. That's the law. So no one was in control anymore. And I love the strange irony here. Paul, who couldn't be stopped from going to Jerusalem, remember? He had the love gift for the church after his third missionary journey. They all said, don't go, it's going to be terrible, you'll be arrested, you'll be bound, it's going to be miserable. You can't stop me. Now they're saying, Paul, do you want to go to Jerusalem? And he said, you can't make me. I'm going to appeal to Rome. I'm heading the other direction. And so Paul had more confidence in receiving justice at the hands of Nero than he did at the hands of other religious people. Now, theoretically, if I were dividing up the New Testament, that would be the end of chapter 25. Because chapter 26 begins with the final hearing. You can't have a trial anymore, so it's just a hearing in front of King Agrippa. But because that would make chapter 25 really short and chapter 26 really long, those who were wiser than me 400 years ago came up with this division, continuing here and introducing the last stage of what we're seeing here in Caesarea. As we begin in verse 13, we see not just the new politician and the old conflict, but we see the added assistance of a partner that comes on the scene. Verse 13, do you have it? Now when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice, that's how they would pronounce her name then. We would say Bernice, and so we will say Bernice so that it doesn't irritate you every time you hear it. Agrippa and Bernice arrived in Caesarea and greeted Festus. And as they'd stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there's a man left prisoner by Felix. When I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and elders of the Jews laid out a case against him, asking that the sentence of death against him. I answered that it wasn't the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accuser face to face, had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charges against him. Now, stop for a moment. Let me give you a tiny... See, as soon as I say a tiny bit of history, your eyes all roll. Did you know that? I can hear your eyes rolling. Oh, no, another history lesson. King Agrippa II, that's who this guy is, Agrippa II, he ruled the kingdom up in the northwest corner of Palestine. A little, nothing. King Herod, in his original kingdom, controlled all of Palestine. Now, King Herod the Great was his great-grandfather, by the way. His son, Herod Antipas, beheaded John the Baptist. Remember that, King Herod? Okay. And then his father, Herod Agrippa I, is the guy who cut off Pastor James' head, you know, like Peter, Andrew, James, and John the fisherman. James was the pastor in Jerusalem, Acts 12. And Herod Agrippa, this guy's dad. So this guy is well familiar with Palestine. He's well familiar with the politics. He knows all about the Jews, and he knows all about the Christians. I mean, he had first-hand experience here with what it was. And now his son, Herod Agrippa, had inherited a little corner of that kingdom, way up by Caesarea Philippi, up towards Damascus, up in the corner. We don't have our map up here, but, you know, up here in the corner of the land. He appears down in Caesarea to Festus. He brings his sister, Bernice. Bernice is a lovely woman. She is beautiful. She is the younger sister of Drusilla, who had been Felix's wife. Obviously, they came down to Caesarea all the time. Here they're coming down again. A couple days on a cart to come down from their kingdom down there to there. So Bernice was the younger sister. She had married King Herod Chalcis of that little kingdom. He died. She became the mistress of the Roman general Vespasian. And then when he went back to Rome, she became the mistress of his son Titus. Sounds like more than a little history here. And then Herod Agrippa says, well, okay, Bernice, you're the widow of this guy. If I marry you and you marry me, now wait, remember, they're brother and sister? If we marry each other, then I'll inherit this little kingdom up here. You'll be the queen, and we'll have all this money and power, and this will be, and we'll all live happily ever after. Even the Roman historian condemned this incestuous relationship that they had. When you read about it in Scripture, you think that they're a husband and wife team. Herod, or King Agrippa and Bernice, they're brother and sister. Okay. So Festus was confused. Not as confused as they were about who they loved and what they did and how this all worked out, but he was confused, and so he's thinking, this is fantastic. I've got a guy who knows Israel. They know the Jews. They know Christians. I can bring this up and get some advice here what to do. Verse 17. So when they met, he said, when we met, that is the Jewish leaders and Paul and all that, I made no delay. On the next day, I took my seat on the tribunal, ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of anything evil like I'd expected. Rather, they had put certain points of dispute about their own superstitions and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but Paul said had raised from the dead. See, the Jewish leaders had hoped to make an easy case of this, and Festus is just confused. He expected serious crimes, and instead it was the story of the Messiah. Festus was as ignorant as a bag of hammers about what Paul's message was. How do you tell somebody who the Spirit of God has not enlightened about dying and rising again? Why do you think the world celebrates Easter with a bunny and a basket of eggs? They don't understand the concept of a resurrection. They don't understand the concept of a God who is in control of life and death. And so now he's laying this out, saying, what am I going to do? And Agrippa's curiosity is gripped. He said, oh, okay, this is an interesting story. Verse 20. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried regarding them there. When Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for a decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said to Festus, I'd like to hear this man. And Festus said, tomorrow, you know, hey, I've got help now. I got somebody who understands the mentality of these crazy Jews. They want to kill people over somebody who's dead and not dead. Now, there'd be no jurisdiction here. There'd be no trial. Well, there can't be. There's no charges. Poor Festus is saying, I don't even know what to charge him with. It's confusing. Claudius Lysias, remember the centurion or the tribune who arrested Paul? He sent him to Caesarea so that they would find out what charges were there. He couldn't figure it out. The Sanhedrin couldn't figure it out. Felix, now Festus, nobody. And if he sends him to Rome with no charges, I'm sure Governor Festus is saying, oh, they're going to laugh me right out of court. I'm going to lose my job. If I can't handle this situation, what am I going to do the rest of my life here in Palestine? So, verse 23, the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp. They entered the audience hall with military tribunes, prominent men of the city. And at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. This is not a trial. This is more than a hearing. This is the Academy Awards night. Okay, I bet Bernice was walking on the red carpet in a new dress. I mean, great pomp. All the leading men of the city, the tribune, not the centurions, but the guys who were in charge of 10 centurions, the leading military people, everybody's there. Pageantry and who's important, and they wanted to show that they had the real power, the real class. Of course, now in history, it shows how little power and how little class they actually had. Verse 24, Festus said, King Agrippa and everyone present, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me in Jerusalem and here shouting that he should be executed. I found he'd done nothing to deserve death. He appealed to the emperor and I decided to go ahead and send him. So the governor is already saying, I've already made my decision. He's innocent. But now we have this hearing among this leading Jew, Agrippa the king, and we'll make sure we have the right charges. So that's how he closes the chapter in verses 26 and 27. The culmination. He says, I have nothing definite to write about to this Caesar, to my Lord. Therefore I brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we've examined him, I might have something to write. It seemed unreasonable to send a prisoner and not indicate the charges against him. You know, Romans were sticklers for law, and he couldn't say, well, I don't know what he did wrong, but everybody thinks he's bad, so I'm sending him to you. That just doesn't cut it in the legal profession. And he knew it'd be a risky thing, to, you know, I have to write something. So, how do we tie a bow around this chapter? The second trial, as it were, the second hearing. From a human's viewpoint, the events that have transpired here are a comedy of errors. A litany of human failure. Paul goes up to Jerusalem. He's arrested in the temple. The Asian Jews are saying he's doing something wrong. He wasn't. They don't have any proof, but they stir up a riot. The Roman commander doesn't know what to do. He's going to whip and beat Paul until he finds the truth, and then, oh no, he'll let Paul talk to the crowd. bigger riot. Bring in the Sanhedrin, bigger riot. Go down to Caesarea in front of Felix, bigger riot. Confused, clueless in Caesarea. That sounds like a movie title. Clueless in Caesarea. But from the divine perspective, you see how all these quote errors are really the fulfillment of God's plan? God had said to Paul, I promise you this, you're going to go to Rome. Paul planned, I'll go to Rome, then to Spain. Journey number 4. God says, I have journey 4 planned out. You're going to go at the government expense. I'm even going to get you a ship. As a matter of fact, it's going to be 4 different ships because he gets in a wreck, but that's another sermon. See, the divine hand of God, he gets to share the gospel with the crowd in the temple. He gets to share the gospel with the Sanhedrin. He gets to share the gospel with the centurion, tribune, Lysias. He gets to share the gospel with Felix over and over again. Now he's sharing the gospel with Festus, talking about Jesus and the resurrection. Festus doesn't know, but see, God says, I've got this all in control. Everything that's happening might seem confusing and bad and discouraging and weary, but it gives you the opportunity to share the gospel. See, that's what gives me hope about today. I don't know about you, but today, these are confusing days. We're living in a mess. The whole society and world and health and all the everything is just crashing down. You say, what a terrible thing. Life is futile. Curse God and die. As Job's wife said. But see, our human viewpoint is not God's eternal plan. I've had people who listen to our sermons online during the lockdown time who never had looked at them before, never had heard them before. We have people who said that they're getting chances to witness more and more. Our next door neighbor, my wife was with my leg in a cast. I couldn't go out to do the watering on the side yard. And she's moving the hose, and the next door neighbor lady came out, and they're talking about the world and all the terrible things that are happening. And my wife said, what are you up to? And she said, well, I started to work on my RN at the college. She said, it's like something inside of me said, I can do more than, well, she's a bartender, okay? Said, I can do more than what I'm doing for this world. I can be a nurse. And she said, is Bob still able to preach with his leg in a cast and all of these other things? My wife said, you can't stop him. I try. I trip him. It doesn't work. You can't stop him. And this gal, folks, this dear lady, my next door neighbor, says, well, amen. Amen? When's your next door neighbor said amen to you? Don't answer that, Kathy. When's your next door neighbor said, and my wife said to me when she came in, she said, God's working through all of this mess. See, God's got an eternal plan. Does it surprise you that nothing surprises God? That he knew all about the quarantines and lockdown and health and riots and wars and famine. Did God know about that? Everything is in God's hand. It's all under his supervision and control. He's still at work in our world just like he was in Paul's, even though if you looked at this, you keep following this story that we're preaching week after week, and you'd say, boy, some of this must have taken God by surprise. This is really, you know, what in the world? God's in control. See, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creation. The old passes away, the new replaces it. And as Paul wrote to Romans, right after the verses I read earlier in Romans 8, we know that all things work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. Paul's going to go to Caesar. God promised it, and God's going to fulfill it. We'll watch it happen. But before then, he's going to get a chance to preach to one more king, King Agrippa. He's going to get a chance to preach to one more crowd. He's going to get a chance to preach to a bunch of people who are fearful of their life and the shipwreck in the Mediterranean storm. He's going to get a chance to preach on the island of Malta. He's going to get a chance to preach in Italy. And yes, that's journey four, the journey to Rome. Missionary journey five, he's going to make it to Spain. He's going to continue on. Because, see, we see from human perspective, and we don't understand how it's going to work out. God is in control.